Good evening and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I'm John Tanza in Washington on this live broadcast from Studio 14. Here are some of the top stories making news across Sudan and South Sudan this Tuesday, February 21, 2023. The leader of Sudan's military group, the leader of Sudan's paramilitary group says he regrets taking part in the October 2021 military takeover.
Unfortunately, I came to realize that the coup was used as a bridge for elements of the previous government to come back onto the political scene once again.
And the tenure of South Sudan's transitional period ends today.
The 24-month roadmap extended transition period officially comes into effect from midnight of Wednesday, the 22nd of February 2023, to end by the 23rd of February 2025, with elections held.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. The deputy chairperson of Sudan's Sovereign Council and the leader of the paramilitary group Rapid Support Forces says he regrets for taking part in the 2021 military coup that overthrew former Prime Minister Abdalla Hamdok. General Mohamed Hamdan Dagalo says he is committed to implementing the framework agreement, which calls for the integration of all Sudanese forces. For VOA News, Michael Atit reports from Khartoum.
General Dagalo said this week he regrets taking part in the October 25, 2021 military coup, and the political situation in Sudan has worsened, noting military leaders are unable to address the problems they thought would be resolved in days.
Unfortunately, I came to realize that the coup was used as a bridge for elements of the previous government to come back onto the political scene once again. I no longer have doubts about this. I came to my senses and I'm sincerely ready to exit from the political scene in the country and hand it over to a transitional civilian authority.
Military leaders overthrew the government, citing division among civilian leaders. Dagalo was named deputy head of Sudan's Sovereign Council immediately after the coup. He says it is no longer secret the military alone is unable to address the country's political problems.
It is now time to put an end to this political deadlock and urgently reach a quick political consensus that will establish a transitional civilian authority that will lead this country. We have to go back to our barracks and continue to carry out the constitutional mandate of defending the sovereignty, border, and security of this country.
Dagalo's address to the nation on Sunday coincided with the signing of the new implementation matrix for the Juba peace agreement between military leaders and Sudanese armed opposition groups. It extends the implementation of the agreement by another 2 years. Sahar al-Jizuli, a Khartoum resident and a member of the Abu Adam Pro-Democracy Resistance Committee, says Dagalo's statement indicates division between military leader Abdul Fattah al-Burhan and Dagalo, commander of the Rapid Support Forces.
If he is really serious about implementing what he said, that means he has taken a positive step ahead of all the parties to the military corps. The political situation shall witness a true change after his statement.
Sudanese political analyst Mohamed Wedabouk says Dagalo's statements make clear division exists between military leaders on how to apologize to the people of Sudan. Wedabouk says the division confirms earlier condemnations of the coup, which were ignored by al-Burhan and Dagalo early on.
I think there are fears among the coup parties from each other, which is now clearly coming out through such an open statement. The preliminary stance of the Sudanese people is that the military should leave the political scene and they should not have any political role.
Both al-Jizuli and Wedabouk say it is high time military commanders step aside and allow civilian forces to form a civilian-led government that will prepare Sudan for elections. Michael Atit for VOA News, Khartoum.
From Khartoum, we move back to Juba, where the South Sudan Unity Government says the tenure of the current government ends today. A new transitional period kicks in on Wednesday this week. The announcement marks an official start of the new roadmap for implementing the 2018 peace deal. For VOA News, Wake Simon Wudu files this report from Juba.
The leadership of the unity government made the announcement during a briefing to reporters, diplomatic community, civil society and faith-based organizations at the Foreign Affairs Ministry building in Juba. South Sudan Cabinet Affairs Minister Martin Elia Lomuro says the gist of the new roadmap is to provide time-bound guidance on the implementation of outstanding provisions of the revitalized peace deal that are critical to holding peaceful, democratic elections at the end of the transitional period.
The 24 months roadmap extended transition period officially comes with effect from midnight of Wednesday, the 22nd of February 2023, to end by the 23rd of February 2025, with elections held by December 2024.
Parties to South Sudan's 2018 Revitalized Peace Agreement agreed to the new time frame for implementing the peace deal last August. Tomorrow marks the end of the 36-month transitional period since the unity government was established per the 2018 peace agreement, but Lomuro acknowledges that several key provisions, including security arrangements and a constitution-making process, remain unimplemented.
The Ministry of Cabinet Affairs, Justice, Constitutional Affairs, and Finance and Planning are required to fast-track preparation of a budget for implementation of the Roadmap on the Constitution-Making Process Act 2022, and all the relevant institutions are urged to implement sections of the Roadmap that are pertinent to their mandate within the proposed timeline.
Information Minister Michael Makwe, who was at the briefing, says extending the transitional period will not change the policies of the government.
People have been receiving so many wild rumors, and this is the root cause of this press conference. There have been a lot of wild rumors that the parliament will be dissolved and it will be reduced to 250, and that the vice presidents will be reduced to two, and that James Wani will be going to the parliament, and that the executive will be reduced to 19, and so forth and so forth. There are so many wild rumors. One thing to assure you is what was stated by my colleague when he read out the statement, that we are not touching any parts or provisions of the agreement. We are not violating the agreement, but extending the period only in order to enable us to implement the unimplemented parts.
Makwe claims the arms embargo on South Sudan remains a challenge to implementing the peace agreement.
We have moved a lot. And the items which are left now are only two to me. That is the arms embargo, which is an obstacle, and will continue to be an obstacle as long as that arms embargo is not lifted. And to me, this is an obstruction of the implementation of that.
Civil society activists are calling on the parties to the deal not to use the extension of the transitional period to buy time. Activist Wani Steven tells South Sudan in Focus he would like to see leaders follow the roadmap.
To put more effort than what they have already put in the RCS, and to make sure that they implement the roadmap. And also, there is a need for the leadership to provide the civic and political space for South Sudanese to speak, even if speaking means that he's speaking against, you know, some of the things that they might be doing. He's speaking against, let's say, failure to implement the roadmap itself.
Steven says the political space in South Sudan needs to be opened. For VOA News, I'm Wake Simon Wudu in Juba.
The South Sudan Chamber of Commerce is calling on the government to remove illegal checkpoints near the Nimule border crossing point where traders are taxed. Some traders say they have no choice but to increase the prices of goods to cover the cost of illegal taxes. For VOA News, Dengai Deng reports from Juba.
Ugandan businessman Isaac Tuhame, who brings a vegetable to Juba through Nimuli, says taxes levied at the border crossing point have doubled recently, some of which he believes are illegal.
The border issue is too much like in Nimuli. We are paying a lot of taxes as we are bringing the food items. So, like last month, they double taxes. They double taxes in Nimole. Because we normally bring the car we was paying at least like 350 SSP. But they increased up to 530 SS per truck.
Tuhami says traders have no option but to increase the prices of goods to cover the higher taxes they are being forced to pay at the border.
We add prices, but the buyers, they don't have money. We add prices, and these things we are selling, it is rotten. So we add prices, but no buyers. People, they are crying, they don't have money. The problem, it is one, because of dollar. You know, here, everything, it is going by dollar. Dollar, this dollar for Southern Sudan, it is not a fixed price. Southern Sudan, now with dollar, you can get by 82. Tomorrow, you get by 85. So if dollar, it is fixed on one price, like when we say that it is 80, we can balance our business. But all things nowadays, we are working on losses.
South Sudanese trader Amza Musa Abdallah says the high taxes negatively impact his business too.
We are being charged by the revenue authorities. They are charging around 116. And then we have another taxes for the service fee. They are charging us something like 120. And just imagine for someone who's selling vegetable, fresh vegetables, and you are charged by such an amount of prices. It's a lot of challenges. Though some prices are negotiable, some of the charges are negotiable, but it's still high compared to our products we are selling.
Addressing reporters in Juba yesterday, Losidik Lukak, acting chairperson of the South Sudan Chamber of Commerce, Industry and Agriculture, said traders entering South Sudan through the Nimli border crossing have experienced delays in clearing their goods due to unnecessary taxes imposed on traders. Lukak urges the government to stop illegal checkpoints at the country's borders where traders are being illegitimately taxed.
The complaint is not about the bad roads, but about the people who are taxing the traders illegally to pay $100 as traffic fee on the border of South Sudan. We, the chamber, condemn the illegal taxes along the border.
Lukak says his office received reports from traders complaining that aside from other taxes, they are being forced to pay $100 per truck in what is called a traffic fee. Lukak says the high taxes have forced some traders to enter illegally through porous borders between South Sudan and Sudan. He says the government should work with Sudan to quickly reopen border crossing to prevent the illegal entry of goods into the country.
There are traders who are coming from Sudan through Awin illegally because of high taxes. Government is working to ensure all border issues are solved.
Major General Daniel Justin, a spokesperson of the South Sudan National Police Service, who is also a spokesperson for the National Interior Ministry, says he is in Kenya at the moment and could not comment on border taxes. Several phone calls to his deputy James Dark went unanswered. Last year, South Sudan's Interior Ministry said it had created a task force to handle illegal checkpoints as a way of eliminating the illegal collection of taxes from traders and travelers across the country. For VOA News, I am Deng Gaideng in Juba.
Listening to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Coming up, what was the outcome of the African Union summit? Stay tuned for answers after this break.
What do you think? People speak out on important questions. The question today:
is wealth an important factor when making marriage decisions?
Wealth is not an important factor when making marriage decisions because most wealth is best acquired when you're together as a couple.
Of course, I think that any decision that involves another person, that's only fair to include wealth as an important thing. Like, I can live on almost no money, but I couldn't expect my wife or my children to.
Not wealth, but security, financial security. Because if you're planning to have kids, then you need to provide for them.
What do you think? A daily discussion of important questions from VOA. South Sudan in Focus is now on WhatsApp. Send us a message on +1 202 630 8011. Tell us what's happening in your area or give us your feedback on the stories you hear on South Sudan in Focus. We look forward to hearing from you on WhatsApp. That number again, +1 202 630 8011.
You're listening to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. The African Union Summit, held over the weekend in Ethiopia's capital Addis Ababa, addressed many issues afflicting the continent. But as in the past meetings, the issue of peace, security, and its impact on governance continues to challenge the continental body. The leaders expressed concern over what they call persistent conflict, terrorism, and violent extremism on the continent and called for collective approaches to security. They called on the countries in transition like Guinea and Mali to respect agreed-upon timetable towards the swift restoration of constitutional order. Political analyst Ibrahim Kani is based in Addis Ababa. He explains to Daybreak Africa host James Batty why the African Union decided to maintain the suspension of Burkina Faso, Guinea, Mali, and Sudan.
I think the conclusion was Mali and Guinea and Burkina Faso was going to be suspended. The sanction cannot be lifted until a clear understanding is made between ECOWAS and those countries about not only the duration of the transition, but the step that they need to take to really make sure that the transition is reached in those countries. And here, the responsibility was given to ECOWAS because ECOWAS met at the level of head of state to take those decisions, because AU functions with the principle of subsidiarity. It's for the region to make the decision, and if the region cannot make or is unable to make a decision, the continent will take. That's the first reason. The second reason is that AU, unlike ECOWAS, doesn't have a regime of sanction. It has a regime of suspension. AU can only suspend, but AU generally doesn't have a regime of sanction. ECOWAS has a regime of sanction.
It seems to me this summit, much of the time there was spent with the peace and security. In the Sahel region and the Lake Chad region, the African leaders seem to be very concerned about the rise in terrorist activities in these areas.
Well, it's the reality of our continent. You know, the report that the Commission made to the summit about the peace and security situation on the continent, he employed the word shocking. The reality of the continent in terms of peace and security is shocking. And what makes you better understand that shock is that an evaluation of the first 10 years of the Agenda 26-3, which is now the AU guide on anything that member states have to do to really hope to get to a kind of integration and development of the different countries. That report said that 76% of the resources utilized the last 10 years for the development of the continent was dedicated to peace and security. It tells you about the situation of the continent.
Ibrahima, it seems to me the African Union has placed a lot of trust in the regional organization, particularly as it pertains to the conflict in the Democratic Republic of Congo.
Yes, they have done that because what happened, you know, for the first time in many years, the East African community has deployed soldiers at the border between Rwanda and the DRC to deal with the situation created by the M23. And apart from doing that, they decided to really organize a meeting during which Kagame, Tshisekedi, and all the other actors that are involved in this crisis to sit down and to talk about the situation. And it was done, as I said earlier, at two levels. One is among the East African only, and two, after that, among the 15 members of the Peace and Security Council.
Before I let you go, we talked earlier about the situation with Mali and Guinea. What happens now with the transition there?
Yes, everything is frozen in Guinea. Frozen because the government doesn't want to talk to the real actors on the ground. The government wants to choose who to talk to. Two, the government is not really interested in redesigning the transition, designing the time frame for the 24 months, because they accepted already that they will stay only for 24 months.
That's political analyst Ibrahima Kane speaking to Daybreak Africa's host, James Batty. Three contenders are competing to take over from Nigeria's President Muhammadu Buhari in a battle that pits the old guard against a third-party candidate who is seeking to harness anger among young Nigerians. David Doyle has more.
Nigeria will elect a new president on February 25th. There are 18 candidates to take over from Muhammadu Buhari, but just three considered to be top contenders. They are in a battle that pits the old guard against a third-party candidate, seeking to upset the established political order. So, who are they? Bola Tinubu is the flag-bearer for the ruling All Progressives Congress, a party he helped form with Buhari a decade ago. Nicknamed the Godfather of Lagos, the 70-year-old is the influential former governor of Nigeria's most populous city. Over the years, Tinubu has forged religious, political, and ethnic alliances across the country. But he has also been followed by allegations of corruption, which he rejects.
We will create wealth. We will turn a year ahead. It will be our Eldorado.
Tinubu aims to continue Buhari-era policies like building public infrastructure. He also wants to end a costly fuel subsidy and channel the money to agricultural and social welfare programs, as well as expanding the military. He is an ethnic Yoruba and a Muslim, and has departed from the established norm by selecting a running mate from the same religion. Nigeria's main opposition party is fielding Atiku Abubakar. It's the 76-year-old former vice president's third attempt. He lost to Buhari in 2019. Like Tinubu, Atiku has been dogged by allegations of corruption, which he has dismissed as baseless.
Every part of this country will be given a sense of belonging. No part will be sidelined. No part will be marginalized.
Atiku plans to privatize the state oil company and ensure a greater role for the private sector in the economy. He also wants to liberalize the exchange rate and provide more equipment to the military. A northern Muslim from the Fulani ethnic group, he has selected a Christian governor from the oil-producing Delta State as his running mate. That points to a strategy of generating support in the largely Christian South. Looking to upset the established order is Peter Obi. The 61-year-old former banker and governor says he wants to build a new Nigeria.
Those who left, even the young people who are today living, they'll come back. We want to bring them back. Nigerians are prepared to come back if they can find that they have a country to go back to.
Okay. His policies include tripling power generation and better funding for the military. He wants to gradually wean Nigeria off its reliance on oil by ramping up agricultural output and exports. Obi is a Christian from the Igbo tribe in the volatile southeast. His running mate is an economist and former senator from the northern Kaduna state. Obi has generated a substantial buzz among young Nigerians as he seeks to harness their anger against the status quo.
In Kyiv, Ukraine, on Monday, the President's Day holiday in America, U.S. President Joe Biden announced additional military support for the embattled nation. Biden heads to Poland Tuesday, where he will discuss U.S. efforts to relay support for Ukraine in its conflict with Russia. Reporter Miroslava Gongazi has the story from Warsaw, Poland.
Since the start of the Russians' war on Ukraine on February 24, 2022, Poland has become a key player in confronting Moscow's aggression and indispensable U.S. partner in the region. Over 7 million Ukrainians have crossed the Polish border as refugees, and 1 million are temporarily settled here. 1 year later, President Biden will speak at the Royal Castle in Warsaw to highlight U.S. efforts to relay support for Ukraine. Monday, President's Day, he spent in Kyiv, the city that, as he said, stole his heart. He has announced additional delivery of military supply for Ukraine, as well as additional sanctions against elite and companies who are participating in Russia's war machine. He emphasized that over the last year, the United States has built a coalition of nations from the Atlantic to the Pacific to help defend Ukraine with unprecedented military, economic, and humanitarian supply. A year ago, the world thought Kyiv would fall. 1 year later, Kyiv stands, and Ukraine stands, democracy stands, said President Biden. Miroslava Gongadze, VOA News, Warsaw.
And that's all we prepared for you on this Tuesday. We now leave you with some Rababa song from Sudan's Blue Nile State. Listening to a Rababa group from Sudan's Blue Nile State. I'm your host, John Tanza, on this live broadcast from Studio 14 here in Washington. Don't forget to visit voaafrica.com for all your favorite programs and news updates. If you miss this broadcast, go to www.voaafrica.com/South Sudan. Thanks for taking time to be with us. Remember to join us tomorrow for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America.
The magazine,
the
magazine,
the
magazine.
Agarawan, 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 Agarawan,